The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, November 30th, 2018. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It's Casual Friday, folks. I am wearing my soft-collared shirt and will be inviting on the program Ben Dixon from the Benjamin Dixon Show. Also on the program today, Matthew Film Guy from a learning annex, JCC, in Long Island City. Also on the program today, in the wake of the Cohen plea deal, Trump reminds people it's very good it's very cool and legal to do business with the Russians. And presumably so to giving Putin a $50 million penthouse apartment. Also on the program today, G20 kicks off in Argentina. The world leaders are snickering at Trump. And the racist judicial nominee from North Carolina going down. Elections may actually have consequences. Meanwhile, CNN fires Mark Lamont Hill because of the consequence of advocating for Palestinian rights. And 500 million user accounts at Marriott Starwood Hotels have been breached over the course of 4 years. So they're on it.
To help with connectivity.
Meanwhile, Joe Crowley's role revealed in the Hakeem Jeffries win. Also on the program, congressional Democrats to release H.R. 1, the first bill of the new Democratic caucus. Paul Ryan suspects something weird. It's red flaggy all over the place in California, he says. Totally red flaggy. And migrants stage a hunger strike at the Mexican border. Meanwhile, Fed explains millennial spending. Laura Loomer seems to be still chained to half a door.
Solidarity.
And the plans to maintain, or I should say, build on the Yemen resolution in the Senate yesterday. And will Chuck Schumer stop Joe Manchin from being the committee chair of the Energy and Commerce Committee?
What do you think? Prospect. Oh, hold on. The Baileys are on the line. Not only does Joe Manchin get the committee chair, he gets the keys to my apartment.
I was going to say, yeah, I have a counter offer for you. You're the committee chair of two committees. That one, and we'll also put you on the whatever you want.
Date night with my wife every other week. Take Mrs. Schumer out for Chinese.
All this and more, ladies and gentlemen. On today's Majority Report, we've got a lot of stuff for you today. Later in the fun half, I think we will get to the first shots fired in the war on Christmas, which will provide us an excuse to recount my contribution to the war on Christmas that is now as old as the Christmas tradition, almost. We will get to that later in the program. But first, ladies and gentlemen, as I remind you that this program relies on your support, You can become a member of the Majority Report today by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. I want to read a little bit of email that we got. We got this on my birthday, which I thought was apropos. As you know, last year on my birthday, the Mike Cernovich started his campaign to get me fired from MSNBC. This year on my birthday, and I don't know if it was a coincidence or what, but we got an email, and the email is it's quite interesting. We have decided to do it as a little playlet. We thought it would be more apropos. The email is from a doctor. Now, we do not have a doctor in the building, so instead, playing the role of this conservative doctor will be the character right-wing Nelson Mandela. And I will be...
Hello, Samantha.
Yes, thank you for joining us. I will be playing the role of myself, who goes through the emails, and particularly when I see a hate email, I respond very quickly. So
the only thing that relieves your sciatica.
That's right. It's true. There you go. What a coincidence. Playing a doctor already providing.
See? Yes. See how that works?
Yes. Method. Okay. So if we could now, we take you to our email inbox at majorityreporters@gmail.com, where this email came in.
So Sita says that Trump supporters should kill themselves. Really? Sita, you should kill yourself, you fascist pig. You are disgustingly stupid, Dr. Charlotte.
That's right, and we've gotten rid of this second name, obviously, to protect the non-innocent. I responded, link please, not sure what you're referring to. And Dr. Charlotte came back with this quote.
MSNBC host says Republicans need to kill themselves,
etc. And she and I was like, what's going on here? I don't recall I said that, but it seems very similar to what happened a year earlier when Mike Cernovich. But in fact, so she said she wrote that, and I with a link to the American Journal Review, which also got this from the Washington Free Beacon. No, go to the American Journal Review, which is the link I sent you, and it indeed says MSNBC host says Republicans need to kill themselves. Okay, we'll just drag that in, and if you can scroll down, you got to keep going.
This is exactly as it took place. And then he scrolled down, and then he was on the verge.
There it is. MSNBC host says Republicans need to kill themselves, in all caps. quote, suicide may be the only option for these people. He wasn't kidding, it says. And so there's a face. I look maniacal in that picture. And so let's go to the video, if we could. And here it is. This is at Washington Free Beacon. You have the video set up, right? Queued up? Okay.
So I think the Himes calculation is correct, right? They will abandon him if and when it's political peril. The question is... at what point that would be the case.
Yeah.
I mean, again, they're underwater.
Right. But, you know, when you look at the map, right, you know, look at where Trump went into those red states and he helped.
Right.
The problem is that the polarization is such that suicide may be the only option.
Okay. Right. Well, now the problem is with this clip is that just before that, Chris Hayes had said they can't stick with Donald Trump. Speaking of the Senate and House Republicans, because that would be suicide. And so I responded, suicide may be the only option. And I wrote back to the doctor, listen to the video. Your news sources are lying to you. The question was posed, is supporting Trump suicidal for elected Republicans? And I sent that off, and she said,
thank you for the clarification.
So there it is, ladies and gentlemen. Another one of my birthdays go by, and I remain unscathed.
That is so awesome to come out swinging like that, though, and then just get a correct, and you just fast on the turnaround. Oh, my bad.
Hey, that's how the marketplace of ideas should work.
That's right. You fascist pig. Oh, thank you for the clarification. Now, where do right-wingers get this type of mentality? I will say this. Good for her for actually, you know, coming back and looking at the video and looking at the context and appreciating the clarification, because there are some right-wing leaders who will never, ever learn. Let us go to Nashville, Tennessee, where Steve Ducey has put on the world's most obnoxious sport coat to go along with Kid Rock's outfit. Now, I don't know why the two of them are in Nashville. Maybe Kid Rock is getting put into
drunk.
Drunk. Who knows? But he's on Fox and Friends because of all the Kid Rock fans who tune into that to that show. And here's what Kid Rock has: a simple plea for all of us to just get a little more civil.
You know, the division in the country right now, that it's so hard for people just to get past that we can disagree and still be cordial with one another. You know, and just talk about things without going for each other's throats and protesting everything. And God forbid you say something a little bit wrong. You're racist, homophobic, Islamophobic, this, that, and the other. People need to calm down, get a little less politically correct. And I would say, you know, love everybody except, I'd say, screw that Joey Behar bitch. Everybody.
That's the only time they applaud. That's the only time all those people.
I mean, lady.
That's the only time.
I mean, lady.
Listen, she's just got a different point of view than you do.
Exactly. You know, hey, maybe we'll go on and I'll hash it out with her. We'll talk about it. But anyway, exactly. Aside from joking, which I was, is just go out and, you know, hash it out with people and have your thoughts and ideas. But be able to still go have a beer with somebody and just say,
let's have a beer.
You know, let's have different ideas, but try to move forward and be more together and realize at the end of the day, we're all Americans.
We're all Americans, except for Joy Behar, who's Jewish.
You know what Ducey means in Dutch?
Now, Joy Behar, it turns out, is Italian, so he's not. There's nothing loaded about his comments.
Well, look, let me say this, and obviously it can't be racist because I'm saying it, but one word, more. Think about it.
Love how that's the only thing that the crowd erupts in applauding. We got to be friendly with people. We got to, you know, take them out and this and that. And of course, she's a bitch.
Well, it's 100% more honest than when they usually say that stuff,
we
right?
can all get along. We should all have beers. We should all talk to each other, except for that bitch, Whoopi.
Like, if
let
you
me finish my thought, Ducey, you weak. Ducey is...
This is them just continuing.
Yeah, let's just hear them continue.
Ducey means awkward cock in Flemish.
Steve, I know where I'm going in Nashville. I'm going right there. That place looks fantastic.
It's a party at 7:36 in the morning there, local time.
I could see those two on Fox Nation every day. I mean, I can see
they might have to bleep out certain things.
But we do need to apologize. Yeah. We don't feel that way about Joy Behar. So that's we don't condone
don't
that
condone
language.
Language.
Yeah, we do.
You do.
I'm
going to voice bomb that segment. Yes, we do. Joy Behar's a bitch. Trump rules. America first. MAGA.
I like how they apologize afterwards. Like, we had no idea. Kid Rock was such a classy act. We had no idea he would say something like that.
Kilmeade's like, I want to I want to go there.
Yeah, no, that was great. I was like, we'd like to apologize. Kilmeade's like, that guy's so cool. Oh, he's more awesome than the professors who ghostwrite my books.
Wait, can I go to Nashville next time?
Can I go next time? I wouldn't interrupt him like Ducey. I'd be like, yeah,
Ducey is a real bitch. Wimp. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, head back. We'll be back in a moment with Ben Dixon. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Ben Dixon, a host and proprietor of the Benjamin Dixon Show. And now the also, I should say, the I guess the co-proprietor, co-founder of the North Star, which you can get more information at buildingthenorthstar.com. And wow, man, you've already got over 5,000 members have joined. That's amazing.
Yeah, well, actually, we're closer to 8,000 today. It is
wow.
It's out of control. A lot of people are supporting the project, what we're trying to do. Of course, Sean King, it's kind of weird. So the North Star has already been founded, but we're the re-founders. So
right. Okay.
I'm calling ourselves like the re-co-founders. So Sean King is my re-co-founder. And of course, he has a huge audience of people who want exactly what we're proposing. So that's, it's a great model. And now we're in the stage of creating content.
That's great. And so when does it actually launch? Do you know?
So we're going to have we're launching in stages. We're only building what our audience helps us to be able to afford to build, right? We're kind of, it's grassroots media still. And so we're launching the podcast version. We owe the audience a full line of content for podcasts that we're going to try to release before the new year's. The first one is going to come out in the next 2 weeks, the first series. And so we have a lot of great conversations. Patrice Cullors of Black Lives Matter, she's going to join us and she's going to co-host one of the first, our flagship podcast. We have a lot of other great people we have lined up. And then we have some voices that you haven't heard yet that are creating amazing content to be a part of this network. So that portion is going to start rolling out before the new year. The video portion, if we hit 10,000 members, we're going to launch the daily news broadcast. And I'm actually at a facility, which is why, I couldn't stay as long as I normally love to stay with you. But we're looking at the facilities here in Atlanta to build the next studio.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, I'm glad to hear that. All right. Well, folks can get more information and become a member at buildingthenorthstar.com. Very exciting. All right. So, Ben, this week, crazy week, starting with a climate change report that was put out by the Trump administration, congressionally mandated. Trump said it was fine, but he didn't believe any of it. Leading into Trump, obviously, is head to the G20. They just signed and have prepared the new NAFTA for fast track. It's not terribly different than the old NAFTA in many respects. Some help theoretically for auto workers, but 15,000 just got laid off or are about to be laid off by GM. So I'm not sure how helpful that's actually going to be. The some of the biggest news has been what's happening with the Mueller investigation. This thing seems to be picking up, and the sort of the narrowing of it seems to be picking up. But Paul Manafort sort of left the building, but it wasn't quite clear to me that Robert Mueller wasn't anticipating something like this. Give me your sense of what you've seen this week in the Mueller front.
Yeah, so this week, it seems like everything is accelerating. And the closeness and the proximity to Donald Trump, the walls are closing in on him, clearly. The Michael Cohen guilty plea, the implication of it, and just the fact that they have corroborating emails and other people who are going to testify, verifying the account. And even that I think Rudy Giuliani came out and said that the president confirms his testimony, confirmed some of what Cohen or what we've been told about Cohen. It clearly paints a picture of a president who misled the people while he was running for president, carrying out his business activities with Russia in terms of the opportunity to open up in a luxury hotel there and telling the American people simultaneously that he's not doing it and he doesn't have any dealings with Russia. I'm not one to regularly like to agree with Dershowitz, Alan Dershowitz, but I think he summarized it pretty succinctly. This is clearly reason for people not to vote for Donald Trump. But is it to the point of he's in legal peril that we're still I think that remains to be seen. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I don't think that there's anything from what we heard from Cohen that puts him in legal jeopardy. But we don't know what he's what Trump has testified. So on some level, it could be a perjury trap in some respects. But it is clear that Mueller seems to be sort of mopping up the ends, and the Mueller the Manafort thing. It's interesting that it all came down this week, after Donald Trump had written his written testimony. My sense is like we're seeing shadows of shadows. Do you know what I mean? Like there's just stuff going on that we just don't know, and everything that we're seeing is almost like it's like if you're outlining, you have like a little picture and you just keep outlining it and outlining it and outlining it. And by the time you get to that, like 20th Cohen-centric outline, it doesn't have the same shape as what's really going on in the middle. And I get that feeling, but I get the feeling that Mueller's in charge of this. Like he's setting the pace in a way that I don't know that we can even really tell in some respects.
I think he's really, in a way, swinging his weight around a little bit with this week in particular. But I like that you pointed out the perjury trap, because I think the timing of this really tells the story of Mueller giving the president the opportunity to either tell the truth or not. Right. So all of this came out after the president gave his written testimony to Mueller. And so, we really do have to question, how effective were his lawyers in making him tell the truth? Because we know the president left his own devices is pretty much incapable of telling the truth. So this is really going to be a testimony of how good his lawyers were before they made those presentations, gave those testimonies rather to Mueller. But the timing of it and him swinging his weight and really kind of showing the president that he's not in charge of this shit. I think that's really a statement that whether or not he tried to make it, that's the statement that Mueller made this week.
I also wonder, like we hear so much about Trump. What we're not hearing is about Donald Jr. We're not hearing about Ivanka. And we know that they haven't come in front of Mueller. And we know that at least it was reported that Jr. thought he was going to get indicted or was saying that several weeks ago. I can't help but think that the stuff that we're hearing about, right, which is not coming from Mueller's investigation, all the stuff that we're hearing about is coming either from court filings or from defense attorneys who are looking to help out their specific clients. And I can't help but think that, like, the first thing that's out of nowhere is going to come out of is an indictment against one of the children. And just because we're not hearing anything about them. And we know that at the very least, Donald Trump Jr. was intimately involved. He was physically in all of these sort of instances that seem a little dubious.
Right. The meeting with Veselnitskaya in Trump Tower. The email chain that he released himself that he thought exonerated him, which actually implicated him even more. The level of intelligence that he does not operate with suggests that he's in trouble.
Yes, I would agree. And here's a question I will pose to you that was posed to me earlier in the week. At what point do you think, I mean, we're now, you know, we're seeing like polling on with Trump is starting to drop. Part of that, I think, might have been a drop amongst Republicans. Part of that may be a function of what kind of whooping the Republicans took in the midterms. Part of it may be a function of what has come out with Mueller recently. At what point do you think Republicans, or is there a point where Republicans basically cut him loose? I mean, the one thing that we saw this week that had any meaning, and I've been reminded that a broken clock is twice, I mean, is right twice a day. Jeff Flake actually came through. It looks like this Farr, this guy from North Carolina, who's been an expert in voter suppression in North Carolina, is his judicial nomination is dead because Tim Scott and Jeff Flake basically have said, we're not going to vote for him on the floor.
So that just happened because I thought he did. I thought he flipped on that this morning.
What? Jeff.
Yeah, I think this morning he decided to go ahead and give him the vote. But again, I mean, it's all so fluid. It could have changed again. You know, Jeff Flake has this is my worst dad joke ever. Jeff Flake is so flaky. You just don't know where he's going to be at any time of the day. I apologize for the dad joke.
No, that's all right. But I didn't. Is anybody else seeing that? Can you guys, because the last I had heard, but I've been, you know, sort of pulled. I've been in. The last I saw was that Flake was not going to vote for him because, you know, he said he's not going to vote for any judicial nominees that until there's protection for Mueller. Are you guys seeing anything, Brendan? We haven't seen any updates as of yet.
And it was an article that I saw the headline, so, you know.
Well, I guess we'll see. Let me see if I'm okay. No, I don't see anything new about Flake, but
to answer your broader question about when will they ditch him? Honestly, that's still a function of how strong his, you know, where his bottom is. The bottom for Trump has always been somewhere around 36-34%. And those are people, I mean, those people are pretty committed to Donald Trump. If he starts losing there, then the Republicans have an opportunity to ditch him. But I just don't know how much of this is going to affect his core base.
None of it. That's my guess. None of it. He's never going to lose that 36%, whatever that floor is. And the problem the Republicans have is that increasingly those 36 are represented in their politics by Republican senators and Republican congresspeople. I mean, that's why those people showed up at work, basically, or coming in January, because they're in very red places, right? Like North Dakota. Was it Kramer who's coming in? He's never going to abandon Donald Trump. That's why he's there in these districts where the Republicans won for the most part. They're never going to abandon Donald Trump because his people are their people. Seems to me.
That's their meal ticket, right? I mean, if you look at the race, Trump said one thing that was pretty accurate. He said that the people who embraced him won. You know, the more people embrace Donald Trump, the better they perform in those particular districts that are blood red. So, you know, Republicans do have a model problem. Like, how do they model a win outside of Donald Trump? Good luck. We'll see.
Right. I agree with that. All right. Now, let's turn to for a moment to the Democrats. And we should just say, you know, Tim Scott, I mean, Jeff Flake, obviously, he's on his way out. He made one promise, assuming that he kept it, which is, you know, a big assumption. Assuming he kept it. Tim Scott, obviously, it was a little bit harder for him. Being the only African-American senator in the Republican caucus to basically say, I don't care about a guy whose entire career seems to have been built upon voter suppression that any other Supreme Court that, you know, if the DOJ was still doing preclearance would not have allowed at this point.
Right. Right. You know, and, you know, it's a small win, so I'm not going to knock Tim Scott completely. But he's wrong on so many other issues that, you know, this is just a broken clock. again.
And, but do you think that also, like, a weakened Donald Trump also has something to do with this? I mean, a slightly weakened Donald Trump. I mean, really at the edges.
Well, possibly. I mean, you have to take that in consideration. But then you also have to ask yourself, at what point do you have any soul left? You know, do you have anything left in you, Tim Scott, that you would fight for? Are you going to bend over for someone who clearly has animosity towards minorities and their capacity to vote? Are you just going to prostrate yourself for them? And so it could be a function of Tim Scott having a backbone finally on something. But, you know, which one is greater? I don't know.
All right. So let's turn to the Democrats in the House and the Senate. Barbara Lee lost, and there was a story for her, you know, the one position in the House leadership that was sort of up, was in contention. This was, I think, Joe Crowley's previous position. Barbara Lee was, I don't know at what point Hakeem Jeffries jumped into that race, but Joe Crowley, the guy who because he lost his primary to AOC, was vacating, he apparently, according to a piece in The Intercept, went around, told a bunch of Democrats that Barbara Lee had sent a check to AOC in the primary, right? So the implication being this person in the who wants to be in the leadership was gunning for Democrats, incumbent Democrats. Now,
right.
There's nothing right or wrong. You know, there's no rule against that. And I am obviously in favor of all primaries. But from the perspective of some of these House members, they're like, I don't want to put someone into leadership who is willing to go after someone in leadership, you know, in a primary, right? Like if someone's willing to do that, then she's out of control. Well, it turns out she sent the check after the primary when anybody from Steny Hoyer to, you know, across the board sent checks to AOC.
Right.
You know, just as a way of saying, welcome on board, you know, you won the primary. Your take on that?
So that's a level of pettiness and entrenched politics that I'm glad he's gone.
Right.
You know, good. Like this is perfectly, this is a perfect example of why, even though he was seen as progressive by some for whatever reason, this is a perfect example of why we don't need that style of politics there. Now, for the people who remain on the Hill, the Jeffries, the people who voted against Barbara Lee, you know what? I mean, I want to make this statement first. You know, their vote is their prerogative. We try to influence it as much as we can, but they're not bound to, they're free agents, right? I want to say that because I think sometimes we take that out of the equation. That's always a part of the calculus. But they have a bigger problem on their hand. They may have stopped Barbara Lee, but they're not stopping Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Right.
And I don't think that they're going to stop Barbara Lee. I actually think this is going to empower her a little bit more in terms of the grassroots support from the people. So in they thought they did something, but in actuality, I think this is going to backfire on them in the long run, which specifically to say all of the leadership is in peril. They may have preserved or had some, you know, some revenge because of his position, Crowley's position. But now all of the leadership is in peril and for good cause. Like we're not just switching out corporate Democrats. We're talking about some truly progressive people who have gone up and have significant influence and power that they have to be held, that they have to take into account.
Yeah. I mean, the problem is that, you know, Hakeem Jeffries now has a bunch new set of resources. I mean, that's what we're talking about, right? Is we're talking about just, you know, resources, ability to sway votes. And he is, you know, to put it mildly, less than optimal in terms of where he is politically. This is a guy who's like a big charter school supporter, certainly within the context of New York State. He is a guy who takes a lot of big PAC money. He's a Wall Street guy.
Definitely corporate him.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And He is as situated to be the speaker as anybody who is under the age of, you know, 60, right?
Yep.
And that's just about, there's nobody else. There's, you know, I mean, maybe 70, under the age of 70 in the House. I mean, Steny Hoyer and Clyburn and Nancy Pelosi, all north of 70. And so it's not just a question of age in terms of sensibility. Mm-hmm. Barbara Lee was over the age of 70, I believe, or you know, maybe just. But there's a sensibility that she has that's different. But the age is important insofar as, like, we know there's going to be a leadership change relatively soon.
Yeah.
And who's going to fill that are people who are, you know, who have the inside track. And that may be Hakeem Jeffries now.
Yeah, I totally agree with that analysis. I think you make a great point, but I can't discount the populist uprising that's happening. I don't want to overcount it, but I can't discount it. I think that with the momentum that AOC seems to be able to maintain so far, let's see when January actually gets here and she actually starts serving. And the energy around that groundswell, I think that can carry over into the 2020 election and send even more progressive voices. There's a possibility. I just want to say we're not out. You know, he won that position. He is in a good position to become the speaker if that's what he wanted to pursue. But there's still a good chance that we can have a more progressive future if we continue to model after what AOC has done and others have done in this last election cycle.
I mean, he only won by 10 votes now. So it was 123 to 113. There's, I don't know, I guess maybe three or four more congresspeople coming in.
And this is going to play well, right? When you realize that they got it wrong, that this check was donated after the fact, right? And that this was a manipulative tactic by Crowley. That's not going to play well for Jeffries over the next 2 years. People are going to remember.
I would think, right? I mean, that's what I didn't necessarily see much of that in this story. You know, by any congresspeople going like, "Hey, wait a second, we just got hoodwinked." I got to imagine, right, that there's at least 10 people out there going like, "Hey man, I got screwed over. I had my colleague lied to me, and I find it hard to believe that Hakeem Jeffries didn't know about it. And if he's going to lie in this context, how can I trust him in another one?"
Exactly. That's a critical thing right there. And you know who can help with that? Us, people like us, people in media, people on social media. Like, this is literally, this is something that we can remind people of on a regular basis. This is not something to let them forget. You know, they wanted to be petty and vindictive and they were wrong about it. So let's return in favor because this actually does have a lot to do with the future of the leadership of the Democratic Party.
Right. And can folks do me a favor here? Don't say this election was rigged. Don't say it was stolen. It was the guy running, or, you know, someone supporting the guy running, basically told a lie in support of his own candidate. And that's not rigging. That's not a stolen election. That's an election. And the people who voted for Jeffries, we can encourage them to see the person they voted for as distrustful. But if you oversell this stuff as being rigged and whatnot, people are just going to stop listening to you.
Sam, you actually, that's a perfect dovetail for this conversation, because that's why I put that at the beginning. People have autonomy, man. They you know, when you say it's rigged, you strip away someone's individual autonomy to make their own conscious decision. These people made their conscious decision, but now they made their conscious decision based on a lie. So it's far more powerful to say that you've been lied to than to say, "Oh, this is rigged and this is just corporate them selling out." That line is not going to get us anywhere. But if you remind them that their autonomy was robbed because they were lied to, that's an entirely different argument that sticks and resonates.
Yeah. And it's infuriating. I mean, I feel, I frankly, I mean, I've said this before. I think it's the same thing with when it came to the Sanders primary with Clinton, and I don't know where else I've seen that frame, but it's a stupid frame, and it's not helpful because people you can't convince anybody of something when you go and oversell it in that way.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you, I mean, it's an irritating frame because you, in that sentence, you're saying that this person, that these people who make these decisions have no capacity to make some decisions on their own. They're just a part of a machine that was rigged against X, Y, and Z. And in this case, you know what? They made their decision on the best information that they had at the time. It just turns out that they had been lied to. And that's the frame. I think that's a winning frame to keep reminding people as Jeffries tries to move up in the ranks that his presence there is based on a lie.
Yep.
And that I can stick over the next 2 years.
Let's just talk briefly about what's going on in the Senate, too, because yeah, I mean, geez. And I don't know if this is part. I know in the House there has been. There has been talk, and we spoke to David Dayen earlier. Was it this week? Maybe it was I think it was this week, about a Monday, about the Progressive Caucus in the House went to Pelosi at the beginning of the week. She is still involved in a fairly robust leadership fight, right? She seems to have made some type of peace with those no labels folks, but there's still people who voted against her within the caucus. And my understanding is that of the 20 some odd people who voted against her in the caucus, or 30 some odd people who voted against her in the caucus, that she released them to vote against her in the caucus because they're going to vote for her on the floor. It's easier for these people who said, like, I'm not going to vote for Nancy Pelosi to be speaker until my option is her or Jim Jordan as speaker.
Right.
And that's what, you know, that's what I think is happening there. But the Progressive Caucus got the ability to put 40% of its members, or I should say 40% of each major committee, to be members of the Progressive Caucus. And they're trying to convince their membership to leave maybe their seniority in one committee to go on one of these more key committees like finance and ways and means and appropriations and two others. One's the Intelligence Committee. I can't remember the fourth. Maybe it's Energy and Commerce. In the Senate, there's a similar dynamic going on with Chuck Schumer, Joe Manchin, and Joe Manchin is sort of seems to be poised on that committee to have the seniority to step in and become the minority leader in the Senate of that of the Energy Committee. And of course, he's from a coal state. He's going to get a lot of coal money. And really, it's up to sort of Chuck Schumer to sort of block him from doing that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm seeing this conversation as two monsters, and just let them fight and destroy each other, because Chuck Schumer is doing with the trying to offer some funding for the wall. And then now he may play the role as a hero against Joe Manchin, who to me is just as disgusting. I honestly don't have a positive thing to say about either one of them. So I'll just let them destroy each other. It'd be good for me.
Yeah, but the problem is that they could also not destroy each other, and we get the worst of both worlds, where Chuck Schumer is like, sure, I mean, have a seat.
You know, thanks for sobering me up really quick, because that's probably what's going to happen, right? I mean, Chuck Schumer is, how do we get stuck with Chuck Schumer? This is the biggest question of all, and how do we make a path to getting rid of him and somebody, particularly Joe Manchin? Like, if the first person that has to go is Joe Manchin, but Chuck Schumer, I got nothing.
Yeah, I don't mind Chuck Schumer in the Senate per se. I mean, I would rather him not be, but the real problem, it seems to me, with when it comes to Chuck Schumer, is that he's not just one vote. It's that he's right. the leader. And my understanding is just that it was both Durbin and he were positioned when Reid left to become the Senate, I think at that time, minority leader. And right. just that Durbin just did not have the sort of killer instinct to be that guy. And right. Chuck Schumer took it because Chuck Schumer, the one thing that Chuck Schumer seems to be very adept at is getting Chuck Schumer into where he wants to get Chuck Schumer into.
But then on the, it's an amazing juxtaposition of skill sets, right? Because then he just prostrates himself in front of Donald Trump and offers him this money to build this monument to white supremacy. So he has the ability to get his own power, but he is not wielding that to the benefit of anyone else, anyone that has a hint of progressivism in their blood. So, you know, I'm at a loss. I don't really see the path forward in making changes in the Senate the way that we see the potential for changes in the House.
Yeah, I don't know what the answer is either, but I guess we'll have more time. I'm not sure. Maybe over the course of a presidential campaign, maybe one member of the Senate jumps into the presidential campaign, gets out relatively early, but has increased their stature in a way that maybe might be helpful. I don't know. I just, I don't know. Maybe if we have someone to the left of Chuck Schumer in the presidency, you know, Chuck Schumer, who is extremely transactional, it seems to me, can be steered in a better direction. I don't know, but,
right there. So having somebody in the White House who's to the further left than Chuck Schumer, because otherwise we're stuck with a Chuck Schumer who rewards Chuck Schumer.
Benjamin Dixon Show, buildingthenorthstar.com. Thanks so much for your time today, man. I really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, Sam. Thanks for having me.
Okay, bye-bye. All right, folks, going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will be talking to Matthew Film Guy. You know what? I got to update this. JustCoffee.coop. Usually we give a 10% coupon, which gets you 10% off. You could use the coupon code majority until I think it's the next two weeks at JustCoffee.coop. It's 30% off. You don't need a coupon code, 30% off. Jamie, Jamie is literally making a note to herself right now. This is a great deal. Free shipping still. You can get a 5-pound bag of coffee, 30% off. If you're one of those people who goes to the supermarket and you don't buy you don't buy, Maxwell House anymore, but you actually go and get decent coffee, good coffee in beans, in a bag, you should check. Now is your time to check out Just Coffee. They do this, I think, only twice a year, and this time it's shorter. JustCoffee.coop. You can go. You can get the Majority Report blend, which is Brendan's favorite. I don't think he says that just for my sake. But you can get any other type of blend there. Fair trade coffee started in the Zapatista region. That's why they have that red star on their coffee. Fair trade. Check it out. They got a bunch of different, they got the light, bowl and bold roast and all that. So what's that?
I just said, hell yeah.
There you go. Boom.
I was just in the Zapatista region and it was beautiful and amazing. So you're supporting a beautiful society when you buy justcoffee.coop.
There you go. 30% off. Do that over the next, 2 weeks. All right. We got to take a quick break. When we come back, Matthew Film Guy.
It's just a bad movie where there's no crying. Handing the keys to me in this red line. Where the love that you loved in the sweet says there's no prying. When the breath that you breathed in the street screams there's no science. When you look how you look then to me, then I see sublime and fall into silence. Is this a lie? so there's no climax, no more new territory. So pull away the IMAX in the slot that you sliced through the scene. There was no shyness in the plot that you passed through your teeth. There was no pity, no fading. Film begins on a kid in the big city.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, every now and then, the day is Friday. And every now and then, on those every now and then, it's a smaller subset of Fridays, but a significant subset, on those Fridays, we have the opportunity to play this song.
Matthew, the film guy, is choosing a
Film Guy, Matthew Film Guy. Hello, Matthew Film Guy.
Hello, Sam Seder. Hola, Samito, should I say.
Por qué?
Just to spice things up.
Just in celebration of Jamie returning from Mexico, is that what's going on?
I'll go with yes.
All right.
Tenemos que practicar nuestro español.
She needs to practice her Spanish, apparently. It's verdad?
Sí.
We're so close to making this show all in Spanish. I can only imagine. Matthew Film Guy, what is new with you? I know at this time of year you start to get very holiday oriented, and you know, your eBay page explodes. What is that? What's happening?
Definitely. Everyone should go check out my eBay page. You can find me at Langdon Boom on Twitter, and there's a link there. And usually it's just turning over last year's Christmas and Hanukkah presents to pay for this year's Christmas and Hanukkah presents. You follow my logic there?
Yeah, I totally do.
It's an environmental stance more than anything else.
Wow. Now, you have a list that you have posted, if I am not mistaken, on Twitter that you did just moments ago, maybe in anticipation of this, every movie
right.
I have seen since 1995.
That is correct. I've taken the natural lull in the editor business cycle at the end of the year to finally get on top of a project that I've been wanting to do ever since basically the internet was invented, which is take the extremely nerdish list that I've kept of every movie I've seen since around December 1995 and commit it to posterity on the internet to share with all my fellow film guys and gals out there. And I use the social media platform Letterboxd, which is like a movie-based social media platform. And it's pretty cool. You get to see the posters and you can kind of talk about it with other people. And so it's out there for your film guy extravaganza experience.
Now, help me out here. What's the order about? Is Life of Brian the first movie that you saw in 1995?
Well, actually, here's actually how it breaks down. The first about 40 to 50 of those are what I was able to recreate from a file I've kept as a film guy of all the sort of receipts from movie rental houses and like movie tickets and all the kind of just paraphernalia I've accumulated. And I was able to kind of recreate the first like lists and things that I've kept, the first few movies I started to see when, you know, I turned like 13 or 14 and I had an uncle who was like a real film loving type guy. And he said, you've got to see these movies. So the first about 10 or 15 are all the ones that he said, if you think you're going to be a film guy, you've got to see these. And then somewhere around, I don't know, 50 or 60, it starts to be the actual list that I kept accurately every single movie I've seen for the past, whatever that is, 23 years.
So this is the order in which you saw them starting when you were 13. Is that what I'm to understand?
Yeah, I mean, there's a gap between, like, I'd say 1989 and 1995. I saw a ton of movies that are not represented there, but I wanted to include those first 30 or 40 because I feel like if you're becoming a film guy, you could do worse than watching those first 20 or 30.
All right, well,
so it is one, like, go ahead.
Should we go through some of those just so you can say a brief
feel
word?
Feel free.
Life of Brian, I assume most people, well, no, I mean, maybe that's my own bias. I assume most people are aware of that film. It's a Monty
it's an
Python
movie. Classic.
It's very funny. It's not, you know, the Holy, what was their first movie? Was Holy Grail their first one?
That was their first one, yeah.
And that
after
one,
the
I think,
show
is
went off the air in 71, yeah. Go ahead.
And do you want to say something about that? Or, I mean, I think I've probably said enough. But
well, I'll just tell you, my personal connection to it was the reason that's the first one is that, you know, I had, like a lot of kids my age, I picked up a video camera and was making ridiculous sketches and things like that in the backyard. And my uncle saw some of them, and they involved, like, you know, chopping off hands and kind of bizarre, morbid humor. And he said, the first two he said to me is, you've got to see The Life of Brian. And you've got to understand who Monty Python is, and that sort of started me off loving Monty Python. And then he said, you've got to see Harold and Maude, because he said, you sort of remind me of Harold with all these, if you've seen Harold and Maude, the sort of fake deaths. So all this kind of stuff, absurdist violence and things like that, that was the in for me as, I was closer to 14 or 15, I think, at that time.
And Harold and Maude, of course, is the famous spring-fall romance.
Spring, deep winter.
Yeah, romance. Maybe it might spring be might be part of, early like, spring.
It might be like March and early February.
Yes,
it's sort of like
the next
New Year's
year.
Eve
the
next and New Year's
yeah,
Day,
yeah.
basically.
Right. Yeah. Is the Dark Knight, is that the one in, is that Holy Grail?
No, that's, yeah, Holy Grail.
The Black Knight.
The Black Knight.
Yeah,
that reminded me of
yeah,
Sam.
So Life of Brian.
That
is,
reminded me of Sam and Cernovich, actually.
Right, that's right.
yeah, he was trying to kick you in the kneecaps as you were just, like, walking away laughing.
Life of Brian was about Jesus, or more or less.
Yeah.
And,
okay. What have the Romans ever done for us?
Jesus,
Life of
the
Brian,
guy born
right?
in the manger next to Jesus. If that doesn't sell it to you, then nothing will.
Life of Brian's great. I mean, they're both great, yeah.
At Close Range, what's that one?
Oh, that's an awesome movie. It's about Christopher Walken is like a criminal, and his sons are Sean Penn and Chris Penn. It also has Crispin Glover, and it's sort of like a family crime drama, but it's sort of like a cult movie, and it's not exactly a high, you know, it's not like high on the list of cinematic masterpieces. But it's just a great sort of 80s crime drama that if you're into that kind of stuff. Because around that time, he also sort of said you got to see Taxi Driver and Mean Streets and this kind of stuff. So this is where my thinking was at that time. But I highly recommend it still to anyone, fans of those guys. It's really a tour de force of those actors.
And Joe is number four. What's Joe? I don't even remember that one.
Well, I think I just recommended that to, I guess, was I on just with Michael? Or
yeah,
is your memory that bad? Joe is, I think, one of the most important movies that anyone can watch these days. It's about the sort of the racist at the end of the bar, and he. Is this not ringing a bell?
No.
Peter Boyle plays the quintessential Archie Bunker character, and it's basically about a rich middle class or upper middle class banker who goes looking for his runaway hippie daughter, who is like tuned in, turned on, and dropped out. And she's living in like a commune, and he's going after her, and he runs into this guy Joe at the bar, and it basically becomes like they stalk these hippies, and they try to like hunt them down. But I don't really want to give away what goes on. They kind of like wind up hanging out with the hippies, and it's this real like, you know, generation gap movie from 1970, and Joe himself embodies who basically Donald Trump is like the Joe president. And at the time, he was just a crank at the end of the bar. Now he's sort of moved into the mainstream. But, yeah, everyone needs to go out and see Joe if they haven't yet seen it. And, in fact, I'd be remiss if I didn't thank one of your listeners who actually works at Olive Films, who put out the Blu-ray recently of Joe, who unbidden sent it to me, thanking me for promoting the movie on your show. And he also sent me A New Leaf by Elaine May, one of my classic favorites that I've mentioned on the show. So yeah, that movie has just come out on Blu-ray, and I think every listener of this show who's into politics, if there are any, need to go see this right away.
Wow. All right. I guess that makes sense that you would get the DVD, not the platform that you were promoting. But that's all right. We don't need to get into that.
No, I got the Blu-ray. He sent me the Blu-ray.
Okay. The
You weren't tracking the core of the point there.
No, I think you missed it. I'm not talking about the actual, the mechanism.
He totally did a like, oh, in any store. It's like, no, it was a Blu-ray.
You can get one, Sam. They're out there.
Yeah, no, they're available.
Well, then I have to get a Blu-ray player, and I don't have time.
He didn't send me the only one.
All right, I understand. I think you missed the point. Number five, you have The Devils.
Yes.
Don't know that one either. Don't even know that.
Man, Sam, this is a great day for you. Yeah, The Devils. That's Ken Russell. His story about Cardinal Richelieu and how they kind of had a real-life witch hunt amongst certain nuns who are getting a little too politically powerful in a city-state. It's like political intrigue, Oliver Reed, Vanessa Redgrave, some sort of psychosexual perversion in a way. I don't want to give too much away, but if you know Ken Russell's movies, they always have this kind of dark sexual aspect to them. But it's really a great political movie again. Not that these all have to be or are, but it's really about the power of the Cardinal Richelieu's, his reign, his hold on power, and the way that the federal government basically was taking advantage of this city-state that was getting a little too powerful for its own good. And it's about nuns who, masturbate, basically.
Right, of course. Annie Hall, also about nuns who masturbate.
Exactly. They're all the rest of the list is nuns who masturbate.
The Annie Hall, of course, Woody Allen's probably maybe his most famous of films, maybe?
Definitely.
Right?
Definitely. And I think definitely his best movie.
Better than Bananas?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the early funny ones are what they are, but this is the one that it started to be more about, like, not just the yucks, but about sort of, like, relationship insights and
but
a little more,
yucks
you know.
But his movies
sort of
are better. He's so pretentious.
I mean, they get more pretentious than that, than Annie Hall.
I found like Crimes and Misdemeanors to actually be like insufferable. I do like Annie Hall, but a lot of movies that people point to at Woody Allen is like profound. Incredibly pretentious.
Yeah, look, Woody Allen's not exactly a super deep philosopher. He's still going for jokes, but it's they're pulling from less slipping on a banana that's the size of a car than like, why doesn't this woman want to talk to me? So to me, that's a little bit of a step up.
Can you guys still enjoy Woody Allen now, knowing everything that we know about him?
That's a good question. I've held on to Annie Hall just because it was so sort of integral to me, but it's complicated now. It really is. And there's moments in all of his movies now that you're like, ooh, especially like Stardust Memories or Manhattan.
In Manhattan,
where he's literally dating a young girl. I don't know. I'm very conflicted about all that. So, yeah, that's a good
question.
I wish
him and Sun Yi the best.
I hadn't watched.
Frankly.
I don't think I've watched one in ages. Maybe it's been in part a function of that. Like, I don't feel that comfortable with it anymore. I also feel like it's, it's dated. Comedy, I find, gets dated. That's my experience. That a lot of comedy gets super dated because it is so much about a shared understanding at that time that is, I think, less universal.
Transcendent.
Yeah, it's weird.
More deep comedic insight from Samantha.
Yeah, but I will say there are some comedies that manage to do that.
Well, then
time.
I'll still laugh at Marx Brothers movies.
Certain aspects of movies in the silent era that
right.
I guess they don't strike as deeply into their cultural milieu that they can sort of.
Why do those Monty Python movies hold up?
Because I think part of it is they're historical films. That may be part of it.
Did you say Python, Michael?
Yes. Ones you picked.
The Flying Circus definitely doesn't hold up, in my opinion.
Right.
Well, these are not my picks. This is the list of every movie I've seen since, a certain time period. But The Life of Brian, I definitely think, still, the political insight into the hypocrisy of sort of religion and cults and groupthink, that's still as relevant today as it ever was. So in a sense, it transcends all that as long as people gathering together and are hypocrites.
But part of the problem too, it seems to me, in terms of is that new comedic forms become adopted into the sort of the broad comedy culture, and then they get tired. They get tired out very quickly. Like, you know, what was groundbreaking?
Like the mockumentary format.
Yes, the mockumentary. Thank you. I appreciate that, but I don't. You know, I wouldn't use a format. I mean, that's like saying, you know, cinema is tired. Maybe it is.
It may someday. Yeah. I hope I don't live to see it.
But my point is that when Woody Allen was doing Woody Allen, you know, he was unique. Now that just becomes like, oh, everybody was doing that type of comedy. Everybody adopts it.
So that's actually interesting, because that's like the difference. And this is obviously subjective, but like when I first heard Lenny Bruce, I was like, well, I understand that he's historically important, but this is not actually that funny. And then George Carlin was like, oh, this is historically important, and it still seems pretty funny to me. Like, that's an interesting, like, how do you pull that off?
I never found George Carlin.
Never
funny.
Wow, that's bizarre.
But hey, say what you want about Woody Allen. Guy's got a great sense of mise-en-scène.
There you go. That's right.
Sam, would you like to say something about that?
No, I would not.
I would. I'm going to tweet it out right now.
Clockwork.
It's a totally different situation. Woody Allen was a genius.
Clockwork Orange, your next film, number 7 that you watched, of course. Everybody's going to watch that one.
Clockwork Orange. Kubrick's not one that really stuck with me. I'm not like a Kubrick worshiper. I respect him and everything like that, but his sort of austerity and kind of sort of mechanistic film style, it's not, I mean...
Whoa.
He's definitely a genius filmmaker, but it's not my favorite flavor of cinema.
But you stayed in that neighborhood. You were Naked Lunch and then back to Dr. Strangelove.
Yeah.
Strangelove, rather.
Yeah.
And then Duel.
Strangelove was good, too.
This is basic 101, like a film guy stuff you've got to see to understand what is being done out there. A cut above just your, you know, sort of Saturday kids movie.
Well, Dr. Strangelove is a great one.
Why Duel?
That is still my favorite.
I was going to say, we got to touch on that
for a second.
I think
it's still funny. I've seen it recently.
I feel like everybody's watched that, or they certainly should, but Duel, that first Steven Spielberg, is it the first Steven Spielberg movie?
That's right. It was his TV sort of movie debut, and so that was another, like, you know, ground floor movie to get in on, that he was able to make this movie that was just, you know, before the shark and the man on the boat, it was the guy in the car and the tractor trailer trying to run him off the road.
Now, was this the one that ended with the guy driving into the tractor trailer and blowing himself up or something?
A spoiler alert, Sam.
Well,
I'm not
whatever.
You
know what? Who cares about Steven Spielberg? Because what's problematic about this film...
The truck drives off the cliff.
What's problematic with this film, if I remember correctly, is it's the one, it didn't do well, and Spielberg was like, I'm never making another movie for me again. I'm only going to make garbage films that make a ton of money. Now, I don't think that's the exact quote, but that's the paraphrase, isn't it?
I don't know that story. I didn't hear that, and I think Duel was like, you know, it wasn't his first TV that he directed. He'd done a bunch of episodes of other shows and things like that. So I'm really not sure if that's what that is.
It's when he started putting out
you may be
schlock
thinking of Sugar
like Schindler's
Express.
List.
Well, maybe I'm thinking of Sugarland Express. Yeah, that's
just
true.
Schlock,
yeah,
like Schindler's List, right, Matthew?
That's my approach to podcasting.
Right. That's
like Literary Hangover did hit the Come Town Part 2 coming at you,
exactly.
Bastards. Well, actually, I love Come
And
Down.
Then here comes All the President's Men, particularly apropos, I think, in these days.
My uncle was also very eager to teach me about politics and sort of Nixon and what that was like. And now I just recently got a text from him saying, like, I'm so glad you lived to have your own Watergate. I was like, thanks a lot.
There you go. Next, Madam Butterfly. Interesting.
That one I actually saw in the theater. You can skip that.
Okay.
And Butterfly, David Cronenberg, not his best moment.
Yeah, and The Hand. Cronenberg sometimes bothered me a little bit, but we don't need him.
It's because you got a problem with, like, substances. Like
I'd like Scanners.
And all
Scanners
that.
I liked.
Sure.
But I didn't see that one. But Scanners hit at the perfect time for me because, you know, like, I think I was 13 when that came out, and I was just like, oh, that's so cool,
what,
man.
Bloating heads is
that's
great.
Awesome.
Yeah, exactly.
The Hand. What's that? I never saw that one. That's Oliver Stone, right?
It's crappy, but it's Oliver Stone's like first movie. So it was like, you got to see Oliver Stone's first movie, don't you? Not really, but I did at the time.
Now this one, the next one is very exciting to me because I remember when Down by Law came out. I think I was in college around then. It was like the first, I feel like, independent film that I saw. And I feel like Down by Law started the whole, I guess, you know, modern independent film. Maybe that, you know, or was part of that anyways around that
well,
time.
Well, it was actually Jim Jarmusch's previous film that I would hang that title on, Stranger Than Paradise.
Oh, right. Okay. This, you know, was, I'm thinking of Stranger Than Paradise. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Sorry. Down by Law was his follow-up.
Acknowledged by film guys everywhere.
Yep. And I got to say, Jim Jarmusch, I think, just like favorited a tweet or liked a tweet that mentioned me. And I was extremely excited by that.
That's cool. I mean, Jim Jarmusch is also another one of these sort of original film nerds whose his influences, the thing, once I started to love his films, realizing who he was referencing and ripping off and so on, that led me down a whole other sort of tributary of amazing artists that led me to like Chantal Ackerman, who did Jean Dielman, the movie I think I've talked about a lot, about the woman doing housework for 3 hours,
mm-hmm.
or guys like Ozu, or some of these type of other filmmakers, Nicholas Ray.
Make Ghost Dog? Is that true?
Yeah, he made Ghost Dog. That's right.
That's a very odd movie. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, well, Ghost Dog.
You know, he's sort of
a
chameleon. Jarmusch is sort of a chameleon. Some would say, you know, a dilettante. Like he's just doing a little of this. He does a little of that. You know, but I always enjoy what he's done. Dead Man was his Western with Johnny Depp. That's another good one. And also, by the way, Jim Jarmusch from Akron, Ohio, same as me and same as LeBron James. So
wow, interesting. I can definitely see I can definitely see that.
We all three are very similar.
Character. In the Soup, you took like sort of a weird turn here. You, right? I mean, or no? That was sort
No. Alexander Rockwell, In the Soup premiered at the same Sundance Film Festival as El Mariachi and Reservoir Dogs and Gaston's
Lodging.
Oh, wait,
In the Soup. Okay, yeah, no, I got confused. Right, of course. I remember this one.
Yeah.
Young Steve Buscemi.
And Alexander Rockwell has gone on to make some other sort of obscure independent films, but In the Soup just came out as a 4K Blu-ray, which I did not get a copy of, but maybe you will, Sam. People can rediscover that now, but it was sort of out of print for a long time. I think that's actually like when it came out is that point in the list where I saw it. But it's great. It's got Seymour Cassell from all the Cassavetes movies, and it's about an independent filmmaker trying to make a movie. You know, so it really appeals to the burgeoning film guy.
Buscemi was in a bunch of those. Like, independent movie about an independent movie.
Right. Well, Living in Oblivion is the most famous example where they're on the set and it's a haphazard series of mishaps. Yeah,
like
that's a great one too.
Do you like Truffaut?
That's only
movies?
For serious film nerd film guys.
Do you like
Living in Oblivion?
Truffaut movies about making movies.
That Day for Night, it's okay. Yeah, you know, unfortunately, I saw the dubbed version, which at the time was the only one I could see, so it was really hard to kind of, you know, take seriously. Dubbed movies are very hard for
very
me.
Awkward, yes.
Yeah.
All right, so let's talk about this next one. This one interests me. I'm curious your perspective on this. A Perfect World. This is directed by Clint Eastwood. Not only is it directed by Clint Eastwood, the music was composed by Clint Eastwood. And I still remember for a long time I was into, what do you call it? What's that Cajun music? And he wrote a song in there Big Daddy. I can't remember what it was. It's a pretty good song, actually.
Interesting. I did not know that, Sam.
Yes, there you go.
Is it as good as Steven Seagal's reggae?
No, it was good. But Eastwood directed this one.
I never heard it, but I cannot imagine anything's that good.
Eastwood directed this one. It's not a movie I would have imagined that was in the first 15 that you saw.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. That right there is basically where it starts the list of actual printouts of receipts that I've had from renting movies when I lived with my grandmother in high school. So I have a feeling that was her pick, and we watched that one together.
Thoughts?
I can't say it was amazing, but I remember thinking it was pretty good. It's sort of like a neo-noir kind of a thing with Kevin Costner. Again, I literally have not seen it since, that must be 1993 when it came out. So I wouldn't necessarily put that on the film guy must-see list.
If I may, Clint Eastwood, Dirty Harry, great fucking movie, but Invictus, total smear job. Lies. Fuck Eastwood.
Yeah.
All right.
Total well, listen, SJW posing as a patriot.
That's probably a good one to a good place to stop and catch up. Although I see you got Straw Dogs. That was the original, I presume.
Yeah.
And Deliverance comes up. Clerks, of course, that Kevin Smith film. People should check this out. We should put this on. We should link to this on the Majority Report. Blow Up, I see. I'm just going through there. Paths of Glory, amazing movie. Obviously, The Graduate, Blue, The Big Blue, all the Blue films, everything that every.
I had film. A Blue period.
You had a Blue period. Heat, horrible movie, as far as I recall. Tapeheads, I remember that one. It goes on and on, folks. So, you...
Yeah, and I'm happy to talk films with anybody that wants to tweet at me or to talk to me through Letterboxd. It's a brand new account that I've opened, so yeah, put it up there and let's have at it.
So, Matthew Film Guy, what is the film that you would recommend that we watch if we didn't want to have to weed through your list of movies that you've seen since 1995?
Well, this week I want to recommend a movie that was directed by someone who I actually went to film school with and is a very talented filmmaker named Ryan Sarnowski. He did a documentary on this guy named Merle Haden, who was basically the last adherent to a system of economics that came out of the 30s post-depression called Lawsonomy. And it has a really fascinating history to it. I never heard of it. Has anyone there ever heard of Lawsonomy?
No.
It sort of was the basic tenets, as far as the film kind of lays out for you, is that lending money at interest is abolished, and the government will give what they call direct credits to people, so banks don't own anything. It seems like it has some aspects of socialism, some aspects of maybe like Henry George's single tax. But the basic idea was that, usury and lending and interest is outlawed. And then it became kind of like it took off as a political movement. And then it sort of became like a cult. And it sort of eventually morphed into a religion where they had their own sort of church. And they had a center in Iowa that actually became very controversial. That sort of was accused of like kidnapping kids and having kind of basically a cult compound. But the guy who started it, Alfred Lawson, was actually like the inventor of the passenger airplane. He had the first commercial airliner and was like this very sort of a polymath kind of inventor type in the 30s. And then he started doing these sort of speeches that were about how the banks and the fat cats were using you. And this guy Merle was like in his teens at the time, and all throughout the last whatever it is 75 years he sort of kept it going, where every year he sets up a booth at this air show in Wisconsin where their university eventually wound up. And it's the sort of look into his life, which is I thought extremely sort of touching and really informative, and also at the same time this history of this obscure kind of capitalist alternative that I was surprised I never heard of. And it sort of just sort of speaks to what was coming out of the 30s, the kind of possibilities for alternative economics after the Depression. So wait, it kind of is a good lesson for anyone today thinking of similar things.
Wait, what's the name of the movie?
Man Life. The name of the movie is Man Life.
Man Life. This Alfred Lawson, I'm looking up now. Fascinating guy. He was a baseball player.
Yes, he actually, they say in the documentary that he may be the first one to put numbers on the back of baseball players' jerseys. Like, he was this innovator in various different forms, and then he basically became like a religious leader in this kind of occult.
Weird. He also...
So don't let that happen to you, DSA.
What's that? Do become a cult and then a religion?
Become morph into a religion and a cult, yeah. Because, you know, you start off with what sounds like good principles, and then, you know, personalities intervene. I'm not saying it will, but it's just an interesting alternative history of these, of some similar groups.
And I'm sorry, the name, the title of the film again?
Man Life. It's after the title of one of his many tracks. He wrote all these tracks, and it was about how to live healthily and how to you know, have your business be healthy. And it was very interesting. And the documentary is basically an intimate portrait of the last guy to basically carry the torch. And he has, like, stacks of these pamphlets still in his house, and he's still sort of carrying the torch for this weird and obscure alternate economic life.
I can't find it. All I see
sounds
is the Bud Dwyer. Man Life. Is it where? Can you
it's
find
it? It's available on all systems. Available on Amazon. Available on iTunes. M-A-N-L-I-F-E.
One word?
Yep, one word.
Ah, Man Life. Okay, there we go. Ryan Sarnowski, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
Yes, I'm actually
a very, very talented gentleman. Not the best looking guy, but still very talented.
All right.
Regarding the DSA, I'm actually working on a psychedelic earth worshiping religion that's going to fuse and create a synthesis with socialism, but it's very different. It's not a cult. It's a movement.
There you go. It's a movie.
Send me your pamphlet.
And Man Life, pamphlet. Samantha.
And everybody's and you just got to send in. You got to send in cash, right? For that. And no.
Yes.
All right. Well, there it is, folks. Man Life. Anything else we should know about Film Guy Matthew for the time being?
Anything else you should know about? What are you insinuating?
Well, I'm saying if there's anything else you need to tell us.
Anything else I need to tell you? What could that be?
I don't know. That's why I'm asking.
I will say this. It's actually the Central Queens YM and YWHA that I teach at, not Long Island City JCC. But, you know, that's okay. If anybody wants to come take my class, Central Queens YM and YWHA. Forest Hills, Queens.
That is what I was waiting for. Film Guy Matthew, thank you so much for your time today. Folks, we'll check out Man Life and your list of every movie that you have watched since December of 1995. My God.
Thanks, Sam. Talk to you soon.
All right. Bye-bye. Matthew Film Guy, everybody. Matthew Film Guy. I don't believe that we have a Jimmy Reefer Cake song, do we?
Oh, darn.
I do not see one. Maybe it's because of Michael's attitude.
Probably Michael's attitude on social media.
Yeah.
Have you gotten into media? I don't think so. I don't think so.
Ooh, we did have somebody somebody who pulled some Gorka sound clips.
Check me out at all the hypocrisy.
Private part, punch Mitt Romney and burn this mother effer down.
There you go. All right, folks. Well, in that case, we're going to head into the fun half of the program. On Monday, Marcy Wheeler will join us to walk us through the latest developments in the Mueller case. It is, for those of you who have not been engaging in this, it feels like it's probably a good time to start, because when this stuff goes down, it's probably going to be, you know, something that people are going to be talking about.
Because you want war with Russia.
Because of
my question is, how did Marcy Wheeler get compromised into the war agenda?
Well, that'll be the first question I ask her.
By the way, the whole Russia thing's a hoax.
It could very well be.
It's a total hoax, but you hate WikiLeaks and you love my wife so much that you're willing to take us to war.
There you go. So on Monday,
MSNBC.
Somebody else I saw and called it MSDNC.
Exactly. Interchangeable.
I love that. That's good.
Probably more independence of thought on MSNBC. They might occasionally criticize the Democratic Party.
More like MSW Wasserman Schultz.
MSDWS.
Do you know what Rush Limbaugh used to call it?
You know, there's other Jews besides her to support in public life.
More like NSNB superdelegates.
MS, I'm Sam Cedar. I love superdelegates. Say.
Do you know what Rush Limbaugh used to call MSNBC? MSPMS or PMSNBC.
Oh, man.
PMS. He's called it PMS.
That's actually funny. Good. That's the best one.
PMS.
It'd be pretty amazing to be doing exactly this just in the 90s.
Oh, my God.
That would be amazing.
Yeah, oh, my God. All right. We're going to take a quick
you
break.
You don't know what PMS means until you've met my wife, Asvids Foster.
Okay. So
hashtag
just a reminder, this program relies on your support. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support this live show. You support our interviews. And then as a way of saying thank you, we give you extra content in the fun half. Today, we're going to be launching the war on Christmas. The first shots heard between Tucker Carlson and Dave Rubin. Not between them, of course. They're holding the gun together, almost like at the range where you see somebody teaching their young child how to fire a gun.
Don't take Dave Rubin to the range. Just general sort of public service announcement. I think that can end very badly.
Yes,
I'm just talking on a coordination and basic processing level.
Don't forget, folks, that JustCoffee.coop for the next 2 weeks, 30% off. You don't even need a coupon code. Just head over there, JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. This is a great time to check out Just Coffee and see, you know, maybe change your blend, maybe try it for the first time. Maybe try a bunch of different blends. This is the time to do it. You will not have this opportunity again, at least for another 4 or 5 months. So justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Also, the live Majority Report show at the Brooklyn Podfest at the Bell House is more than half sold out now. We're about almost a month and a half away. I would imagine we're going to sell out before Christmas. So you better get on it now. Makes for a great gift. If anybody's over the age of 18, it's only $15. We should have a very fun time there. So check it out. You can go directly to the Bell House, or you can go to our website at majority.fm and get the link. Today is Friday, which means that sometime during this week, one of the days was Tuesday, and on that day, Michael Brooks had his show.
Yes, Michael Brooks Show. Go to patreon.com/TMBS, iTunes, or Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. Get it all. And our live show as well, like a sack of potatoes quickly emptying. You can get your tickets there at majority.fm as well. How fun would it be to go to both shows?
Super fun. Super fun. Super fun. Jamie, yesterday, or not yesterday, but Wednesday, when I asked you, seemed still to have be a little bit like a tequila hangover in a way. What is the story?
Do they have
with
good tequila in Chiapas?
They do.
That's cool.
They have good tequila in Mexico?
I
drink a lot of mezcal.
Well, they might.
There's different mezcal in different regions.
There's different mezcal in different regions, so also tequila, right?
I actually drank mostly mezcal.
Cool.
Now that we got that out of the way, what's happening with the Antifada?
Yeah, so we've been very tired, but we've figured out what we're doing this weekend. Sean and I will be recapping our trip to Mexico, particularly our visit to the autonomous Zapatista community of Ovantique, where we got to speak to the junta there and got a little tour of their amazing, beautiful libertarian socialist society. That was pretty special experience for us. We're going to give a little background on the Zapatista uprising and the continuing struggle in Chiapas. And we're also going to talk about the caravan of internally displaced people that we saw there and give some background on that.
Okay. And Matt, the literary hangover.
Yeah. This weekend for patrons, there will be another installation of the audiobook I'm narrating, Catherine Maria Sedgwick's Hope Leslie. And next weekend will be my breakdown of Democracy in Chains by Nancy MacLean.
Ooh, everybody's waiting with bated breath.
Doing a lot of research on that guy.
And are you going to, is this going to be the definitive
like determination as to the charges about that book?
A few people have written some decent pieces on it, but in terms of podcasts,
no, we got to make this travel far and wide because that's a really important book.
It's going to be, you know,
libertarians. At least this is my bias. Maybe I'll be corrected, but libertarians manipulated the constant liberal urge to own goal by slightly being, yeah, maybe the book was a little bit unfair.
There's
instead of this incredibly important.
There's some
intellectual
pretty liberal
history.
Historians who have some issues with it too.
Yeah, yeah. There's a very,
and I mean leftist history.
No, I understand.
There's a bunch of different types of takes on it, and I'm going to try to do justice to them all. But I think the libertarians that respond to it do so in a revealing way, which is the thing I'm most excited about.
All right, folks. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.